A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
The Intercooler podcast is sponsored by JBR Capital, one of the UK's leading car finance specialists. Now, we only partner with like-minded organisations who really understand what it means to be a car enthusiast, and JBR Capital is a perfect fit for us. It's run by people who really love cars, and importantly, vehicle finance is all JBR Capital does. That alone is what the company exists to do. So whether you're looking to fund a classic, sports car, supercar or hypercar, see what JBR Capital can do for you. And it's not just about very high-end, expensive unobtainium. In fact, the minimum borrowing is £25,000 and the average, £80,000. Head to JBR Capital on social media or jbrcapital.com online and tell them the Intercooler sent you. Right, let's get on with this week's podcast. Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is episode 94 of the podcast. I'm Dan Prosser with Andrew Frankel in person.
In person.
This time.
In the same room.
Yeah. It's not very often that we get to do this, is it?
Not as often as I'd like.
No.
But it is good.
I think that would be, do you know, if I'd love to be able to do that every week, if we could find a place, just sit down face to face. I don't know, it just sort of changes the dynamic a little bit. But anyway, that's a way off, something to work towards. But this week, I think it's quite easy for us, isn't it, to just default to expensive sports cars and supercars.
Yeah.
And to get distracted by that stuff. And motorsport as well, which by its very nature is a sort of exclusive pastime, isn't it?
Yeah. And we're actually very bad arbiters of these sorts of things because, you know, we spend... this will sound crass, but it's no more or less than the truth. We spend a disproportionate amount of our time in expensive sports cars and supercars, which we could never even dream of affording. And whereas, you know, most normal enthusiasts, you know, tend to have to cut their cloth accordingly. So, yeah, it's absolutely right that, so this podcast, we're going to talk about how to drive the car of your dreams without it breaking the bank.
Yeah, how to drive beyond your means, to own the car that you aspire to own without having endless pots of money, and perhaps also how to own a collection of interesting cars without being very wealthy. Because if you're clever, there are ways of doing it. But before we get stuck in, I just want to talk about Rally Monte Carlo for a couple of minutes, because yesterday, the brilliant Sebastian Loeb, at 47 years old, he's almost 48, he won the rally on his return to the series. He became the oldest WRC rally winner, duffed up all the youngsters.
Yes.
And it was just brilliant to watch.
But his co-driver was even older.
Yeah, 50 years old.
Yeah.
And a woman.
Yeah.
Isabel Galmiche. So, yeah, a new co-driver for him.
I think she's the second oldest navigator ever to win a WRC round.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's significant for lots and lots of reasons. Yeah. And she's the first woman to win a WRC round since 1997. Fabrizia Pons, again, the Monte Carlo rally. She's fantastic, actually. Galmiche. She's a maths teacher.
I haven't seen her interviewed. Is she quite sparky?
I don't know, actually, but just knowing what I do know about her, I respect her enormously.
Of course. So
she's a maths teacher. She's never competed at this level before.
No.
Done lots of domestic level co-driving in France. But she got called up to sit next to Seb, the brilliant Seb Loeb, on the world's most famous rally.
Yeah.
And she won the thing. And if I was her, I'd never do another WRC round again.
It is one of those sort of events, isn't it? You know, they've been dotted out about through the history of motorsport where you look back and think, did that really happen?
Yeah.
Could this old bloke who's been out of it for so long, you know, a few days after doing the Dakar of all things in a car that he's barely tested with a co-driver who's never done a WRC round and everybody's thinking, oh, in a type of car he's never been in before, from a manufacturer he's never driven from before, and just comes in and just beats the lot of them. I mean, I know Ogier was unlucky with the puncture. And without that, it would have been... But then he did his jump start, didn't he? So, you know, the pressure got to him. And, I mean, you know, you win any way you can. I think it's just one of the great motorsport stories.
It is. Well, reflect on it and just think it was an extraordinary weekend. Yeah, on Ogier, I mean, he's a phenomenon as well. You know, between them, they are the greatest of all time. You can have the debate about which one is the true GOAT. I know you don't like that phrase. But
it's got to be low because he's done it across different disciplines, hasn't he? Over a greater period of time.
Yeah, he has. And he more than anyone changed rallying at that level for good. You know, the driving style that would win. There were others who were doing something similar beforehand, but really it was Loeb who changed it. So Ogier was sensational throughout the weekend. He did get a puncture on the penultimate stage, which cost him the rally. It's unfortunate, perhaps, but actually, in rallying, particularly in tarmac rallying, a puncture is less random than it is in circuit racing. You get them because...
When you're pushing.
When you're pushing and you're taking big cuts.
Yeah.
So, actually, I think he has to accept some responsibility
for it. Fair play.
It was an amazing weekend because it was the start, for many reasons, but also because it was the start of this new Rally 1 era hybrid cars. And we weren't sure what they were going to be like. They have up to 500 horsepower now, maybe a bit more. So they are as powerful as the Group B cars of the 80s. But they're more complicated, they're heavier, they have less aero than they had before, they have less suspension travel than they have before. So I think lots of people were concerned about what they were going to look like as a spectacle. For me, a lot of the footage I saw was really impressive to watch. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think my only regret is that we had this tantalising battle between these two titans of the sport.
I think I know what you're going to say.
And that's it. They're not competing
exactly
for the rest of the year.
Exactly. So, that's the point. Can you imagine, you know, Lewis and Max square up against each other, but they're just actually a couple of part-timers.
Yeah.
So it's... You know, one rally is fantastic, but imagine if those two were going hammer and tongs for the entire season.
Well, it'd be like F1 last year, wouldn't it?
It would, and that's what you get. You know, and you build hopefully to this nail-biting climax, and we're not going to have it yet. It's one of those. It's like a sort of tantalising glimpse. It's like it's almost like sort of, you know, this is what you're missing, guys.
Yeah, it's such a tease, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I suppose the issue for me, and I know the Monty is a very specialised event, and these two guys, Loeb and Ogier, have won it 8 times apiece. Which is just staggering, really. But even so, between them, they really did make all the other drivers look a little bit silly. Elvin Evans was perhaps the only one who appeared to be on the pace, but he made his mistake and went off.
Yeah.
And Craig Breen deserves a mention because he brought it home third, a brilliant podium. But the others, I mean, perhaps they'll find some form in the next round or later on, but I just really hope that we get the sense throughout the rest of this year that whoever turns out to be champion, because it will not be Loeb and it will not be Ogier, I hope we get the sense that they are a deserving champion.
Yeah.
But
and you haven't got people just going,
yeah,
well, actually, if either of the Sebs had been there, this would have been very different.
Mm. But it seems that that is going to be the case, isn't it? It does seem that way.
But only after, you know, only after the weekend we've just had. I mean, if they'd come in, I don't know, fourth and eighth, then, you know, it would be absolutely fine. But because they have just frankly, shown everybody else in the sport to be not as good as them, and they're not hanging about, there's always going to be an unfavourable comparison. And it may well be there are circumstances, maybe somebody made a wrong tyre choice, maybe there are any number of other competitors, or you know, just need a bit more time in that kind of car, or aren't particularly suited to the Monte Carlo. There are any sorts of reasons why, you know, it's a completely unfair comparison to make. And over the course of the ceiling season, maybe, you know, Elfyn or Breen or anybody could really have challenged Ogier or Loeb. But you can only go with what you know. Yeah. And what we know is that Ogier and Loeb just ran away with it, didn't
they? They did. And I want to just mention M Sport here. M Sport Ford with the new Puma. We look at that and we go, well, it's actually not a full works team. It's got support or the backing of Ford Performance, but it's not a full works team at all, not in the way that Hyundai and Toyota are. And so it's easier to sort of assume that they are minnows in that world. And I'm sure they don't have anything like the budget. I'm sure they don't have the same headcount or resource. However, they do seem to have built the best car, and they are able to do this consistently. When new regulations come along, they get off to a flying start with their new car. And I've been thinking about this a lot. Why might that be? And for me, it's purpose. It ultimately comes down to
purpose. They don't do anything else, do they?
Exactly. So Hyundai and Toyota, okay, I know actually they are professional rally teams. They're properly set up to build and develop rally cars. But ultimately, they're there to market the road cars. It's a marketing exercise.
Yeah.
And manufacturers switch those on and off just like that, don't they? So they don't know that they're going to be there in 5 years or in 10 years doing the same thing. M Sport exists for one purpose.
And the strange thing is, that always used to make the difference in Formula One, didn't it? When you had Williams and McLaren winning everything. But now, and I guess this is just the money, isn't it? Now you have mainstream car manufacturers and fizzy drinks manufacturers who are there to sell cars or fizzy drinks, just outgunning everybody else. But rallying hasn't got to that stage yet. You know, rallying has got to the stage where the team that exists purely to compete in the way that McLaren and Williams, in fact, even Ferrari when it was founded, were founded purely to compete. You know, in rally you can still do it, but in Formula One, that formula doesn't apply anymore. It used to.
There's a sort of purity to it, isn't there, that I quite like. Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about driving beyond your means, or owning cars that, in theory, should be beyond your reach.
Yeah.
What we're not going to do is talk about how to make money out of cars.
No, because it's a mistake, isn't it? Because if you try to make money out of cars, certainly, well, no, I've never done it. But I saw, you know, any number of examples of people who thought, oh, that's going to be a surefire winner. Mm. And so what happens is you end up buying a car for the wrong reason. And that's going to cloud your judgment and make it much more likely you're going to make the wrong call. And you're absolutely right. I think so. The first thing to do, obviously, don't buy a car which you know is going to, you know, depreciate like a bomb. But the first thing to do is buy the car you want to buy. Buy a car because you really love it and you want to drive it. Mm. And what you'll find is probably that if you love it and you really, really, really want to drive it, other people will feel the same way. And it is that, in the long term, which will ensure that your car retains its value.
And also, if you buy a car expecting to make money on it, or specifically to make money on it, you're not going to use it.
No.
You're not going to drive it. No. You're not going to enjoy it. And then it just sits in your garage and it's a worry.
Yeah.
It's totally the wrong way to approach it.
And every time you do use it, because, you know, maybe, I don't know, you sort of feel you should take it out once, twice a year, then you're just going to worry about it wherever you leave it, and you don't want the miles on the clock, and it just becomes a sort of millstone around your neck. It almost stops being a car, doesn't it? It just becomes an investment vehicle. Ha ha, no pun intended. And that's no way for people who listen to this podcast to go, you know, indulging their passion, is it?
No, it's not. So what's the key to this then? I mean, the biggest cost in motoring, particularly if you're buying a new car, is depreciation, loss of value.
Yeah.
You buy a car, you own it for 3 years, and if it's a brand new car, you could lose half the value.
And even, the rest, yeah.
Even if you're buying a car on a finance arrangement, a PCP or a HP, you're still covering that cost. Someone has to. You're still covering the
cost
of
depreciation. And you'll end up paying more for it over 3 years than you would do if you'd been able to buy it outright. Can I just say a couple of that? I think the first thing I would say is, the cars that I have enjoyed, I may be saying this because I can't afford to buy really expensive cars, but the enjoyment I have derived from the cars that I have owned, and I have owned some quite expensive cars, bears very little relation. The price bears very little relation to the amount I've enjoyed them.
Yeah,
I mean, people will be sick to get death of, you know, me and Harris banging on about 2CVs, but we only do it because we love them and we love driving them. And I've had more fun. You know, I had a 1950s Aston Martin once, which today, sadly not when I sold it, but today is a very valuable car. I've had 20 times more fun out of my 1950s, you know, tin snail Citroen than I ever had out of my 1950s Aston Martin. So I think that's the first point to make. Don't just think that a car to be fun has to be expensive or out of your league. I mean, there are all sorts of cars. You know, at the very bottom level, for a grand £1,500, you can go and buy a knackered old MX-5 and knock about in it, and you'll have an awful lot more fun than most people do in, you know, very expensive modern cars. So that's one point to make. And then it's all about finding the right car, isn't it? The right car for you, and avoiding some fairly simple errors.
Yeah.
Like not buying. And one rule, which will seem contradictory, but it's not, but one rule I've always tried to abide by is expensive cars are cheap cars and cheap cars are expensive cars, by which I mean it doesn't really matter what you're looking to buy. Let's say it's a 1970s 911, a 911 SC or something like that, and you find a couple of cars, and one is really quite affordable, and the other is, you know, a bit out of your price range because it's done fewer miles, it's had fewer owners, it's had less of a life. In the long run, if you use these cars properly, it's almost always the car you pay more for, which will end up costing less in the long run. Mm-hmm. Because you won't always be chasing your tail, you won't always be patching it up, you won't always be being let down by it. So my advice would be, decide what kind of car you want to buy and you can afford to buy, and then just get the best possible one. Because certainly if you buy a basket case with a view to restoring it, by the time you've done it, A, you'll have spent much less time driving it because you'll have spent all that time restoring it, and B, you will just have spent more money restoring it than you would ever have spent if you'd bought that car restored at a higher price. So,
very important point.
The most expensive cars are often the cheapest, and vice versa.
Yeah. God, that's really interesting. It's a very good point. I'm glad you mentioned £1,500 MX-5s because, yeah, you're right. The whole point of this is that you don't need to be a wealthy individual or spend lots of money to get your kicks.
Yeah.
And an MX-5 is a brilliant example because they're not going to depreciate. If you stick £1,500 into the right MX-5,
yeah.
And there are no guarantees. Okay, we do have to caveat this slightly. There are no guarantees, but it's very unlikely to depreciate. And actually, I suspect a good early MX-5, £1,500 probably isn't going to buy you an original one anymore because I think they've gone.
Yeah.
But I suspect the second generation cars will look after you very nicely indeed. So if you think about, let's say you're sticking £2,000, £3,000 into an MX-5, it's going to be worth that. And don't write to me when you buy one, sell it 3 years later and it's worth less. But I would be very confident that it's worth that. And so by choosing the right car at the right time, you're not paying depreciation. You're getting rid of that loss of value that costs an awful lot of money. If you buy any number of other cars, you know, if you buy a brand new car, unless you get very lucky and you've offered a 911 GT3 or whatever, buy a brand new car, it's going to lose a load of value. Buy a nearly new car, if it's a Golf GTI, it's going to lose a load of value.
Yeah.
But buy the right car and it will hold its value, and therefore your costs of motoring have been slashed.
Because for most people, depreciation is so far and away the biggest component, that frankly, everything else, your running costs are, you know, combined. Your maintenance costs, your running costs, they are not quite immaterial, but they're very small beer by comparison, aren't they? And so if you can remove the depreciation from it, then you've already got such a cheap car, which means you probably can afford to maintain it properly, which means it probably will go wrong less often, which means you probably will use it more, which means you will enjoy it more. And at the end of the day, you know, I've been looking back, and I have had a couple of disasters. The Aston Martin wasn't good. The absolute disaster was my beautiful 993 Carrera RS.
Oh dear. Should we pause for a moment, or do you want to carry on?
A moment of...
Yeah, reflection.
Reflection on just what a total idiot I was. Well, I wasn't actually, because, you know, my first child had turned up, and, you know, there were good reasons at the time. But I think what that car is worth now compared to what I sold it for, and I just... Actually, but even that, I don't think I lost any money on it.
Good work. There you go. You're proving the concept.
Even that, I don't think I lost any money on it. I think I got my money back. I probably only had the car for a couple of years, but I probably net had a free car. Because I think I probably sold it for a little bit more than I bought it for.
There you go. That's the point.
And, you know, and I went to the Nürburgring and back in that three times. And, you know, I had a whole stack of fun. So it can work even at that. But I know it's only a disaster in my head, because I now know what they're worth today. And that is quite painful. But
but there you go. You used that term, didn't you? Free motoring or free car. Get it right. And these things, it's, I mean, brilliant.
That's exactly the point. Imagine somebody came up to you and said, I mean, let's think of another example. And somebody came up to you and said, here's a really nice 1.9 Peugeot 205 GTI. Have it for 5 years and then give it back. And we'll look after all your running costs. And at the end of it, there'll be no charge. It's a free car.
Mm.
Well, I had exactly that experience.
Brilliant.
Exactly that experience. I think I had over 6 or 7 years. And it's, well, I was very lucky because there were a few people who wanted it. And so I actually made a bit of money on that. But generally speaking, in all normal circumstances, that would have been a free car. And I think it was that way because it's obviously a kind of car that is desirable. And I bought the best one I could afford. And so, you know, and ultimately that's what people always revert to, don't they? Whatever the market does, people always pay a little bit more for the good ones, and rightly so.
Yeah. So did you, when you bought the car, were you thinking this is going to hold its value? This might work out for me. It might creep up in value. Or did you just want a great 205 GTI and the time was right?
I think you have to consider all of it. I mean, okay, would I have bought it if I thought it was going to fall out of bed? No, I wouldn't have done, because I wouldn't have wanted to lose the money. If it was a 1,500 quid MX-5, I'd probably have cared less, because I would have thought, well, you know, whatever happens to it in percentage terms, you know, the sums of money aren't that great, and so it hasn't got that far to fall. But the Peugeot was quite a lot more expensive than that. And so I would never have bought it if I didn't think there wasn't at least a good chance of it holding its value. Mm. I didn't want to lose money on it. But there's a big difference between buying a car and being quite careful to ensure as far as possible it doesn't, you know, take the shirt off your back, and then buying a car because you think that's a way of making money. I never did that. I bought it because I love the car. I'd had one when I was young and stupid in the city, and it was kind of like a slightly sad, you know, retro middle-aged thing, and I just wanted to have that experience again. And actually, unlike most of the cars that I drove back then, driving it again now, it didn't disappoint at all, and it was a lovely thing, and I just loved driving it. And I only sold it for the same reason I sold all my, you know, slightly faster cars, is because, you know, I just didn't use it, not nearly enough, because of the job that I have. There's nothing about the car.
Yeah.
And it was, well, as I said, I made a bit of money on it, but even if I hadn't done it, it would have been an absolutely free car. And you think all the fun you have for nothing.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And it can be done. And you don't have to be, you know, a motoring journalist, and, you know, and it may be that you get a bit more money because somebody's heard your name. You know, anybody can go out and buy, if they are careful, a really nice, fun, affordable car, with the realistic expectation that if they are sensible in what they buy and how they use it, that over whatever period of time they own it, at the end of it, they will have retained a huge chunk of its value, if not maintained it completely, if not actually made a bit of money out of it.
Let's give a couple of examples then. I've been digging around a little bit. And we're not necessarily talking classic cars or 70s, 80s cars. There is plenty of much more modern machines that I think will look after you. One good example is the BMW E46 M3.
Definitely.
Probably the best M3, do we think?
E30. Well, no, actually, for the money, yeah. No question, E46.
So it a few years ago, 10 grand would get you in an E46 M3. Now I think you need sort of 13, 14 as a minimum. But if you want a nice one, you are looking at closer to 20. And actually, it's very easy to drop 30 on a very low mileage car. But let's call it 16, 17,000. They have been, values have been steadily rising on those cars. And so stick in 16, 17,000 pounds. There's a very good chance, I think, that it's going to hold on to that value. And so you can be knocking about in a brilliant modern performance car with a great engine, good chassis, fantastic looks, fun to drive, and it will only cost you maintenance. If it rises a little bit in value, you're offsetting some of that maintenance, and so you're getting close to that free motoring nirvana, that holy grail. It's just so tantalizing. You need a little bit of capital to put in, I suppose, to make it work. But
and you have to buy the right car, don't you? And particularly things like E46s, which... And this is a problem with all cars that are appreciating, but which had a period in their time when they really weren't very worth very much at all, is they get neglected. And, you know, these cars tend to all polish up quite well. So you just need to be really careful about checking it out. You know, also with something like an E46, I'd be worried about how much time it has spent on track. I mean, not that I'd be worried about the engine blowing up, but I would be worried about maybe the suspension being bent because it's been up a few curbs. I'd be worried about crash damage. I mean, anything which might affect my enjoyment of the car or its future saleability. Another point I would like to make is mileage is really, really important. And there's a balance to strike here because obviously if you buy a really, really leggy car, even if it's good, that is going to affect its ability to maintain its value. It'll certainly affect its ability to appreciate. So, you know, you probably, people wanting to buy cars which are really going to look after them probably want to be careful about that. At the same time, if you buy a car which has done very few miles, two things. Firstly, if a car has done very few miles, it hasn't used been used very much, that can be a whole world of pain all by itself because, as we all know, there's nothing that cars like less than not being used. And things perish and they seize up. And particularly if you have a car which has hasn't had a particularly busy life, but then it goes and has a busy life, then that's when problems often turn up. And also, if you bought a really low mileage car, are you going to want it to have a very busy life? Because that'll turn it into a not very low mileage. And the very reason that it was so expensive when you bought it goes away. You know, and you put lots of miles on it. And then, you know, that will be an example of how a classic car could depreciate. So you've got to get the balance right, haven't you? You want a, to me, you want a car, a good used car in great condition that hasn't done a million miles. But I'd not be in any way, and I never have looked for cars with particularly unusually low mileages because I know that they can be a world of pain too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting when we're having this discussion to sort of compare a brand new car to a slightly older car and just have a think about how the financials might work. So let's take as a brand new car, Golf R.
Yeah.
And once you spec it a little bit, that's probably low £40,000. What's that going to cost you? So you might put £8,000 in on a PCP. You might be paying £400 a month, something like that, I would guess. I don't know. I haven't actually looked at the numbers. But that actually is a significant outlay.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to have a think about how else you might use that money. And there are any number of 911s that are likely to hold on to their value, perhaps even creep up. But a second generation 997 with the later, more reliable engine is a good bet. And I think Golf R money is probably about right. Mid-low 40s, maybe very high 30s.
That's fascinating, isn't it?
So the Golf R is going to shed a load of money because it's a brand new car.
Yeah.
The 911...
Isn't.
No. It's... Even though it's...
As long as you get a manual rear drive coupe.
Well, yeah, get the right one. And, yeah. And it will look after you.
Yeah. Should.
It should.
I think we have to be really careful saying things like will.
There are no promises.
We have no reason to think that it won't. But don't sue us if you go and buy a car and don't come back and say, well, you know, process it, it'd be all right.
Yeah. It should look after you.
Yes.
And the difference is you're driving not a turbocharged four-wheel drive hot hatch. You're driving one of the great sports cars.
One of the great sports cars.
Imagine that. Imagine using one of the great sports cars every day. It's fantastic, isn't it? And what they say about 911s is that and actually any Porsche from that era, you need to be setting aside a decent amount of money for maintenance, because they do cost a few quid to keep them going.
Yeah.
And you don't want to scrimp on that maintenance, because that's how you end up with a big bill or a car that's not worth a great deal. But I just find it so compelling that if you can choose the right car that probably isn't going to depreciate, this whole world opens up in front of you. And you can, you could find yourself driving something much more exotic or much more exciting than you otherwise imagined. Now, it is just worth being sort of grown-ups about this, and I know you have been throughout this podcast, actually, but there's a sort of reality check, isn't there, that we have to do. And you've mentioned it already. If you do lots and lots of miles, this might not work for you. If you're commuting 100 or 200 miles every day, you probably are
but,
putting...
But that's probably not most people looking to buy a sort of classic type car.
Probably not.
And if you are going, if you are going to do that, I'd buy one actually that's already done a load of miles, because you know, the more miles it's done, you know, the less depreciation there is going to be. I think the other thing, being sort of practical and sensible, and I do actually think about this quite a lot, and try to do it as much as I can myself, is once you've got the car, obviously look after it, but look after it in a way that can be. You always think about, you know, whatever car you own, someday somebody else is going to own it. Unless you scrap it, one day it will pass on to somebody else. And so that means you're going to have to sell it, or someone's going to have to sell it. And you just want the car, them to be able to see very easily that the car has been looked after. And, you know, that can be as simple as just having, you know, a smartly presented file with all the invoices, with all the date stamps in them. And just to show that you've been on top of the maintenance. Because, I mean, there have been so many cars which I've gone to look at and have seen really nice. And I say, can I see the history? And you get sort of a V5 and the most recent MOT. And you'll go, well, where's the rest of it? Oh, I don't know, wasn't with the car when I bought it. Well, the thing is, unless you're going to go buy a 250 GTO or something, you're always going to have a choice. Almost whatever it is, there will always be another late 997 Carrera 2. There will always be another 205 GTI. There will always be another MX-5. So you don't have to buy the car you're looking at. So choose carefully, and once you've got it, look after it, and also be seen to be look after it, to have looked after it. Because you can lavish. And this is one of the things that worries me about people who do home maintenance, because they never generate any bills, and they may be gifted mechanics. And there are certain lots of people who, you know, in sort of late middle age, you know, who are sort of winding down from work, they love tinkering with their cars. But I would always, you know, look for as much evidence as I could that a car has been really properly cherished and looked after. And so, yeah, I mean, you'd expect that from the person you're buying it from. So there's no reason why you shouldn't provide the same to the person you're selling it to.
Mm. Yeah, very true. It's also worth mentioning that if you're buying a brand new car, you'll get a warranty, which is a huge consideration for a lot of people. If it breaks, you just throw it back to your dealer and say, fix that.
Yeah.
If you're buying a slightly older car, you won't have one of those. You can get aftermarket warranties, but often they won't sell you one
of
those.
They tend to cover the things they know aren't going to go wrong, don't they?
Yeah, and you know, if a car's more than 12 years old, they probably aren't going to look at you. But they're out there, aftermarket warranties, and so they can offer you a bit of
But the thing with an aftermarket warranty is, they wouldn't exist if the people offering them didn't think they could make money out of them.
Yeah, it's true.
So it's like healthcare insurance, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, it's immensely reassuring, and it's peace of mind and everything else. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you're going to end up, you know, the average patient is going to end up spending more on healthcare insurance than they ever have spent on them in healthcare, because otherwise all the healthcare insurance companies would go bust.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you have to factor that in. So if you want to do it for a sort of, you know, for the peace of mind, which I completely understand, then fine. But, it's interesting, isn't it?
Okay, well, there's another concept that sort of ties into this whole idea of driving a car that you didn't think you could afford. And that's building a collection of cars while not being an especially wealthy individual. And I raise this now because a TI listener has been in touch, Chris. Actually, he's called at Silken Flanks on social media. He's worth having a follow because he posts about some of his cars on Instagram. Now, this chap, he likes a particular type of car. I'm wondering if you can guess what. He's got a Bentley Arnage R, a Jaguar XJR, and a Merc S600 at the moment.
That's punchy from a maintenance point of view, isn't it?
Well, he thinks so. Yeah, I suspect probably it is. He says he loves a big, powerful exec saloon. And actually, in his letter, his note that he wrote to me, he said that he really enjoys, and this is quite a compelling case, actually, he really enjoys owning three comparable cars and driving them one by one and really getting to understand how they're different, you know, through a particular set stretch of road or, you know, how one car rides differently to the other. And actually, it's a good way of sort of benchmarking. And it's what we do in our day jobs, isn't it?
Yeah.
We compare cars.
But I think to him, there would be a sort of an additional fascination because we don't really think about it in these terms, but for him, as them being classic cars and driven probably for recreational purposes, there's an insight into the mindset of the engineers who set these things up. And you could think, well, you know, there's a Bentley engineer there's a Bentley chassis team who really like primary ride control, but are happy to let a bit of secondary stuff come through. Whereas the Jaguar, they'd never do that because it's all about, you know, gliding over the bumps. And, you know, if you go over a crest and the car goes a bit light, that's a price worth paying. I don't know. And I would find those sorts of decisions, particularly if the cars were comparable in, you know, size and price and particularly era, I'd love to get into all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And he says that his V12 S-Class, and I would like to know a bit more about the maintenance because, I mean, these cannot be cheap cars to run. But one upside is that insurance on his V12 S-Class for the year cost him £75. I'm not sure how it can be so cheap, but I think there's particularly something about classic cars, not necessarily the S-Class, but classic cars can be much cheaper to insure, which is something to consider.
Yeah.
I suppose one of the advantages of these very expensive executive cars is that they depreciate so fast and so hard from new that only a few years later, they cost a fraction of what they would have done several years ago.
Yeah.
And so that's how you can sort of start gathering a couple of them or three or four of them. And the point that he makes ultimately is, what's more enjoyable? One traditionally expensive car, one brand new sports car, for instance, or is it more fun to have a handful of older cars that between them have a similar value, but you've got multiple different driving experiences at your disposal?
I mean, a couple of things there. I mean, firstly, if you've got a few older cars, you have also to have somewhere to put them. You know, you're not
absolutely
really
true
going to be leaving them out. So that's probably, it's a different kind of investment, isn't it? Or maybe it's a different kind of buyer. But and I know some people are much more relaxed about leaving their cars out in the street. I mean, I'm not. I left my Series 3 Land Rover out last night completely by mistake because I'd forgotten I hadn't put it away. And when I realised this morning, I was like, oh God, it's been 9 hours. I know it doesn't matter, but I'm just like that. But also the other thing is the more cars you have, and you and I, Dan, both know people who have got, you know, very large numbers of cars. And to me, you always have to keep an eye on what are you going to do with it? When are you going to drive it? And, you know, some people like RS Driver, who is part of what we do, has an amazing assortment of cars and they all get used. But I know other people who have cars which just get parked for years. And when that has happened to me, as it has with a few cars that I've owned, and their role in your life becomes reduced to one of making you feel guilty about seeing them, then they're not to have. So I would actually rather have a smaller number of cars, or whatever number it is, that allows you to genuinely use all of them.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, why have you got them?
Mm. Yeah, there you go. I agree with that. It's a tricky thing for me, having a whole collection of cars that, because there are so many, some of them just don't turn a wheel. I'd rather have a slightly more focused fleet. Let's leave that one there. I think the point of this podcast is that if you're a bit creative and you're prepared to do your research and be quite diligent about these things, there's more than just one way of buying and owning a car, isn't there? You don't have to default to the same old brand new hatchback on a PCP.
No.
You can, a little bit of research, a little bit of nous can get you in a truly exciting and interesting car.
Ask yourself why you want it. Ask yourself, what are you going to do with it? And do your research and get the right car. Because so many people, and goodness knows I'm one of them, although I'm better now than I used to be, buy these cars and they're just controlled by their emotions. And that's not a very good way. You know, letting your heart buy a car for you is probably not a very smart thing to do. So just try, because you're going to spend the rest of your time with the car, hopefully subjectively loving it and just adoring having the thing over there, just in that moment, just before you buy it, just switch that part of you and just look at it objectively and just think, is this the right car for me? Can I look after it? Am I going to use it? And then find the very best example you can afford.
Yeah. Words to live by. Good. Okay, let's leave that one there. Everybody, please remember to rate and review the podcast. You have been doing it, and it really does make a difference. It means we can find an ever bigger audience, which is what we want to do. And also, please remember to go and check out the Intercool app. Download the app. Start your free trial. We think you'll like it. And as ever, we'll be back to talk to you again next week.
Look forward to it.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.